Welcome to Androids and Assets. I'm your host, Marshall.
And I'm Steven.
Today, we're talking about a series of short stories, very short stories, from Wired. In the waning days of 2018, they commissioned 8 science fiction writers to imagine the bold and new future of work. And that sounds like completely right up our alley.
That's 100% our thing.
The future and work, it's like economics and science fiction together. So we read these 8 stories.
Yeah, we did.
And you also should read them on Wired, The Future of Work.
Yeah, they're
easy. I think they're worth reading.
It'll take you 20 minutes to do all of them, I think.
Yeah, like they're quite short, which is I think a pro and a con.
Yeah,
like I like a short story, but these short stories, by the time you sort of understand the premise of the story, it felt like the story was over.
Yeah.
And that was true for all 8 of them. It was just like, I was like, oh, I kind of get what's going on here, and scene.
They were all very, yeah. They were vignettes basically of people in a different future world each time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I like, because it sort of does tie someone's hand and you have to get to the nitty gritty pretty quickly. So the stories, I think, were quite engaging right off the hop.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the material, I think a lot of things they engage with thematically is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of horrible.
But then I do think, considering Wired's goal with this was to sort of turn to science fiction authors to make the future feel more real, that we can understand it, that we're not just basing it off of, hard facts and charts.
Yeah.
You'd get a feeling for what the future is like.
Give it text. And I should add that each one of these stories starts with a line from a different white paper.
Right.
Yeah. They all are a meditation on a singular line pulled from a white paper or policy or policy.
Which was also kind of interesting.
Yes.
I liked. But I think with being as short as they were, I don't know that it really, that the whole series collection really gave me a feeling for the future of work. It sort of was like.
Yeah. And I think one of the things you mentioned before is that it's talking about, with all but one exception, talking about a very particular type of work and a particular type of worker.
Yeah. Or even sort of not talking about the type of worker.
Yeah.
It was like a worker was probably a character in the story, but it didn't for most of them feel that the worker was the main focus of the story. It was like the story had something to tell us, and they put a worker in there to talk about the future of the world. I think in some ways it just sort of it missed what I felt was the mark.
Yeah, yeah, and like,
they set up a target and they were just off the side of it.
Yeah, and they completely miss the relationship of work to production.
Yeah,
because none of these individuals are really in a materially productive capacity. The close,
no.
You get people doing maintenance work, and you get people. Well, maybe, yeah. We'll jump into the stories, and we'll get to this. But one of our central things is it's a very bourgeoisie interpretation of what apparently all work in the future is, this sort of bourgeoisie technocracy.
Which it might be entirely true with the automation of labor, but we didn't really see that.
Yeah,
they didn't tell us that labor had been automated.
No, it's just omitted.
Yeah.
It's just deleted. It's just not even there. It's presumed absent. And the turmoil it would therefore create is thus omitted.
So jumping into the stories then, I think if we just go through all 8.
Rapid fire.
Rapid fire in order that they were listed. The first story is Real Girls by Lori Penny. It's, I guess, the story of a sad sack man who in the future can't get a job, so his girlfriend breaks up with him and tells him he has to leave. And so in his desperate attempt to maintain the fiction of his relationship, or the ideal of his relationship that he imagines, he takes a job as a fake computer girlfriend, fake robot girlfriend.
Yeah, he catfishes other lonely losers. So that's still a job.
And it is, it's a job. Absolutely. Like it was kind of, it was interesting where it was like, we don't have good enough computers to actually do this. So we're going to hire people to pretend to be computers to do this. Yeah. And I guess he catches feelings for the guy on the other side of the internet and actually starts doing things around the house. Like he actually makes real food and
it gives him a sense of purpose.
Well, and empathy.
Yeah.
Which I guess he was lacking before. I don't know. I mean, maybe the future is super like homophobic. So he was afraid to pursue a relationship that meant anything to him prior to this. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a strange. It's a strange. And again, it's so short. And there's all of this psychosexual content, just like really tightly bundled up in like the 500 words or whatever this is long, half of which is him talking some guy off, and it's weird.
He talks about how he, you know, walks this man through the motions of getting off, and then he does such a good job he goes and gets off himself. You're like, that's weird.
So I thought Real Girls was interesting, if not in places cringy.
quite cringy. And I don't think none of the characters had redeeming characteristics.
And you feel bad for the girlfriend who's just like, she's trying to, like, because she lets him stay with her, even though they've broken up. Well, he gets on his,
I mean, I sort of felt bad for her, but she also sounded like pretty vacuous.
Yeah. Well, everyone's motivations as they're laid out in the story are pretty trite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She just wanted to go out and party on the weekends and...
Yeah, so it's not...
he couldn't keep up with her, so she kicked him out.
Yeah. Well, except she... Yeah, anyway. Yeah, it's a... Yeah, we don't get into those... We don't get into the dynamics of that relationship. But it's interesting because we have, like, what's work in the future? Cyber sex work.
Cyber sex work.
That's the future of work. Wire had eight opportunities. Made a list of eight things that are jobs in the future. And the first one is online sex work. So let's remember that editorially. Let's think about that moving forward.
Online sex work.
Second, The Trustless by Ken. Is it Liu?
I think so.
Yeah, Ken Liu. Ken Liu, yeah, whoever, everyone knows him. He's written a bunch of stuff. But yeah, that's basically about just like this out of work, or not out of work, this like a poor paralegal guy. He went to law school, but he never passed the bar or couldn't get hired on at a law firm because he wasn't from Harvard.
Yeah, I think they couldn't get even – the person couldn't get an articling position.
Yeah, he couldn't get an articling position. So he just – and now he just like writes contracts on contract for different companies. And but it's also smart contracts. So the contracts are not just legal documents but pieces of code that actually enforce – the articles of the contract in cyberspace, including the release of consideration. And so everything. So it's interesting because it presumes, these smart contracts. And then secondly, it presumes that there is this whole cryptocurrency edifice that the contracts get act upon. So it's like a global online currency system that the contracts manage.
I didn't get the cryptocurrency part of it. I thought it could just be like a regular...
No, it's very explicit about the everything's done in cryptocurrency. And then like he's $200,000 in debt and he goes back to his shithole apartment and there's a family of like six people living next door. And they're like, they're mad at their landlord. And he's like, I'm going to write a smart contract to help us like stick it to our landlord. So, you know, and they're like, I don't know, man. But he's like, yes, the revolution has begun.
Well, I mean, like, it was kind of endearing because they shared contact information.
They bumped. Right? Yeah. They
bumped phones so they could contact each other. And this was the first sort of positive interaction and extending of trust between neighbors.
Yeah. So it was cute.
It was cute.
But definitely has like, this whole story is front loaded with like a whole like cypherpunk, like vision, just put right there. And it's just like, yep, this is the way it is now.
I really wish we had learned more about the type of work that like law school grad.
Yeah.
Was doing because so they were working for sort of what I would have described as like a baby boomer.
Yeah.
Someone who wasn't able to actually write a smart contract. So they negotiated between the two parties, mm-hmm. but then they had to farm out the work of doing the actual coding because they don't know how. So it's like they couldn't like program their VCR.
Yeah.
And then this boomer lawyer, you know, at the end of the interaction is like, so I was thinking like, maybe I could give you a real job and not just contract work. And the person just shut it down and was like, not interested. Just pay me right now.
I'd rather have the security of the smart contract because he had a smart contract with the guy. So I know that.
I guess that's why I was curious about the future, because you could still have a contract as a regular job and it could still be a smart contract, couldn't you? Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, for some reason he's like he's incredulous towards not being a precariat.
It was like, here's a chance to get out of precarious labor, and scoffed at it and went back to their crappy apartment that was run by a slumlord. And I was very curious about what world are we living in here?
Yeah, and this is
this person doesn't have that sort of like what's the nature of work and the nature of power relationships between these people.
Yeah, and this is where I think like I talk about like that cypherpunk ideology being front loaded. Like that's like a very libertarian thing. Like sell your wares, you know, go out, don't be trapped in some bureaucracy, you know, like it's kind of got that kind of piece loaded into it. I don't know much about loose politics, but I thought it's very interesting that certainly I don't know, but like not to impute anything on the author, but this character certainly seemed to have that kind of ideology. And then it shows in kind of his belief. I'm like, yes, it's just about getting the right kinds of contracts that we've, you know, enforcing the right material. We can enforce correct material conditions through like meaningful agency, you know, through free agents forming contracts and business deals with each other that are absolutely enforceable.
Which, you know, like sounds good.
Yeah. Except it, as with all libertarian like thought in square quotes, like doesn't that agency and that equality between business partners does not exist in the social reality.
No, exactly. If you still have all of the power in a relationship, you can force terms that are favorable to you
and detrimental to that other person
and put them in a smart contract.
The contract, the legal instrument doesn't really matter. What matters is the distribution of power and material wealth in the society.
And they even said like you can't force people to be in the smart contract. So even though, you know, the landlord has an obligation to replace the doors or fix the air conditioning, they just don't, and there's no smart contract, so they can continue to extract rent from their tenants without fulfilling their side of the bargain. So it's like smart contracts exist, but you can't. They're not universal. So even if you wanted them, people with power are just like, no thanks.
You know, yeah, you can have a smart contract, but if the smart contract says a robot will come and cut off a pound of your flesh, it doesn't. You know, like.
That's what we do.
Okay.
The next story is Placebo by Charles Yu. It's the story of in the future, we have robots that are sophisticated enough to do like doctor type analysis. They do the medical work.
No bedside manner.
no bedside manner. Exactly. So they hire actors to play the role of a doctor. But all they do is carry out everything that they're told by these medical computers.
Yeah, they're basically...
So it's sort of like, it's the story of somebody who's in hospice, and the doctor is there, you know, trying to provide solace, but having no real idea of what's really going on, or, you know, and the computer is like, now touched her shoulder.
Yeah, they're making humanistic caring actions, and they're not doing differential diagnosis, and they're not interpreting results. They're just there to comfort that person and to be the face of the decisions that the computer is making.
I was interested in like that the computer was saying, here's how to improve your bedside manner. Like,
yeah,
at this time, touch her shoulder. And I was like, I don't know, like if you're hiring an actor to do the job of that person, like to play the role of a doctor, wouldn't you just sort of like say, here's the diagnosis.
This is the thing that made me frustrating, is that why, as a person who's like mental health adjacent in my work, is why would you liken that person to an actor and not liken that person to a counselor?
Yeah, like, exactly.
You know, and then he talks about the reason he was an actor and he was hired for his looks because he was, you know, like he looked doctorly, like a young, handsome doctor. So it became about his capacity to be like looking a certain way rather than about his ability to present empathetically towards another human being, which I think human beings can do with some effort, you know, with effort and thinking about it and practicing it can become really good at.
Yeah.
Better than we can be at, yeah, like looking at like millions and millions of charts and deciding if you have cancer or whatever.
That's the only way to find out you have cancer.
Looking at millions of charts.
Well, I mean, often I think it's just a
couple of charts, but I mean, presumably this computer would be able to look at all the charts simultaneously.
Right. Yeah.
Which, you know, I think that becomes like a diagnostic issue, like how much analysis you're going to subject people to. But anyway, this is a huge digression. So yes, that was placebo. And so this guy walks this woman through dying, basically. And he deviates from the script. Dun, dun, dun.
Well, and I mean, like the person there is like, you're not actually a doctor, are you?
Yeah, he kind of tells the truth.
Which, I mean, in that situation is probably actually the best thing you can do.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, this is the thing, and this is the thing. Yeah, he kind of, yeah, and they just have a nice human moment together as she dies.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's you know. So, well done, Charles Yu, writer of Placebo. But yeah, so future of, so job number three. So job number one, job number three is pretend doctor.
Yeah.
I'm not a real doctor, but I play one in a hospital.
So we have sex worker, we have contract writer, and we have pretend doctor.
Yeah. So we're moving on to The Farm by Charlie Jane Anders. In The Farm, there's a journalist, and he has an insane AI editor, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're talking about this one. This one is like, this is interesting. This is definitely one of those ones where it's like about a person that does a job and about the frustrations that they experience with their job. But it's also, but I mean, ultimately, I think most of the page space goes to like it's all about media discourse because the AI just does its best. It's like a simulation social media. It's like you dump it and then like a million people and all of like, it's a bunch of independent AIs, each representing like a point of view. And they all just basically, you get like your article back and you have like a YouTube comment section of notes. Like,
yeah. You're
supposed to like streamline that into a quote unquote better article, which is, you know, and you feel for the guy. You're just, The Farm is the name of the AI, by the way.
Yeah. You definitely feel for him, but it just doesn't, it didn't feel like a natural evolution of journalism.
I don't know if I agree, because I think like when you have like a journalism business, you could totally see them being like, what is like the most, you already have this where like, what is the most bland, inoffensive editorial line that's going to optimize clicks and views, right? Like,
I
like
guess, just the maybe, you might journalism. Have some doing that where they want to maintain the fiction of being neutral. But I think more and more, we have journalism that adopts a stance and has become fractured.
Yeah.
So you have Breitbart and you have, I don't know, whatever's on the left.
Well, I mean, I think you have Breitbart and then you have, and you have individual journalists on the left because they can't get the money together to run a paper. Like, and then also, but I think even if you look at something like the Gray Zone Project, is not like the Gray Zone Project would never run like a, you know, like they would never run like a piece about like how capitalism is destroying the world. Like they would like, you know, they're very, I'm a big Gray Zone Project fan and big Max Blumenthal fan. And I guess my thing is like, I would hate to liken them to Breitbart, but I guess in terms of like, they are,
but even Fox News, like Fox News, which is supposed to be relatively mainstream. Mm-hmm.
It's
right.
It
has a view and it has a slant and it pursues that.
Yeah.
So The Farm
editorial boards are a thing for sure.
Right. And so The Farm sort of takes the place of that editorial board, but wants to represent all views. And I just don't think that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of like this gross caricature of liberalism. Like there's like,
right.
Like, yeah, that like, it's true. Yeah. Cause it's kind of, yeah. Yeah. I see that now. Yeah. I'm willing to concede that. Yeah, you have.
So I guess it could go either way. Maybe in the future she's right that yes, journalism, or maybe it's just that particular newspaper is like, we are the one true neutral source. You can come here and only get an unbiased view.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think, yeah, which is more likely, I think that like something like a farm could exist, but I think, yes, you would have like farms that are like conscious of their audience. Like
right.
Market. That's not trying to hit everybody. Like if Breitbart has a farm that's full of like gun lover, all of the AIs in the farm have like ridiculous tags.
Like, yeah. Hashtags
gun,
and whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Gun lover 42 says, so, you know, Breitbart, yeah, would have their bunch of right wing troll bots that would review it. And then, you know, I don't know, CNN would have like, I don't know, whoever listens to / watches CNN, which is millions of people. I just don't know them. My parents, I guess.
Yeah. And I don't know, like part of some of the farm, the robots in the farm were also like brain dead media, and where it just like, it's a bot that screams out about,
it's a bot that hates the media.
And you're like, well, why would you put, why, like, if you are the media, why would you have a bot in there that just wants to destroy your work?
Yeah.
If you satisfy it, it means you're not doing your job anymore.
Well, and this is where like I come back around to being like, maybe this is valid criticism, because there are a lot of people in the media discourse that are vying to, you know, they're giving a lot of play and a lot of response to these fascizoid types who are demanding to be heard and begging for like some sort of neutrality or press reform that is, you know, just like the entrenching, like, which is just entrenching their biases and their right wing ideology into the press institution. And I think that's a real thing that's going on.
That's true.
It's the whole nature of the fake news. That's why I talk about like lying press. Like, it's an old, long standing fascist tactic to talk about like how the press lies, you know, your ideas are suppressed, even though you are actually the dominant hegemonic, the social view, you're from a majority racial or ethnic group and you're constantly pandered to, but even the slightest recognition of other views is a personal attack against you. And the right wing has been milking this for literally ever.
The story ended in a way that I thought was very strange as well. In that the journalist takes home, like, he downloads a version of the farm onto like his personal computer and takes it home, and just like,
he develops a perverse fascination with the farm.
It's almost like Stockholm syndrome, where it's like this thing that is harmful to him and that he hates when he's at work, but he's like, oh, but it's great and I love it now.
Yeah. Well, he's just like, what does it mean? Yeah, it's kind of got a 1984. So, oh my god.
Yeah. And I would have thought that the story would have finished with him like, he spent the entire day trying to write one very short article. He starts it in the morning and he plans to be able to go for lunch, misses supper, doesn't get to go out all day long, just trying to like get this story right. And then he goes home at the end of the day and it's just like, yes.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
I mean,
and I would have expected the story would end with him like punching his hand through one of the computers and getting drunk somewhere.
Yeah, like, no, I mean, you know, I don't know. You ever, like, I remember being like a young man and just like, you know, going in the internet and being like, what is all this horrible stuff? And just being like, what is happening? What does it mean?
Yes. But that was when it was sort of like
a million iterations of, is Black Sabbath better than Led Zeppelin?
and also, it didn't affect you personally. It wasn't like your livelihood depended upon what your YouTube comment section looked like.
Well, fair enough.
You'd think this person would just want to numb that pain. Just be like, get that thing away from me. I don't want to see it. I just want to like, yeah, close my mind for a few hours until I have to go back and do it again tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, speaking of numbing the pain, why don't we move along to the third pedal?
The third pedal.
Yeah.
Do you want by Nissi Shull. I guess it is a story, I guess, of caretakers.
Yeah, I think so. And like
personal caretakers.
Yeah. One of the things said in Nissi Shull's bio is that she,
or caregivers,
has worked. She worked as like a home healthcare aide. It's about like home healthcare. Well, I think it's about like a like a client, like an ill elderly woman and her kind of relationship to her various caregivers.
Oh, were they her caregivers, or were they was she organizing caregivers?
Well, she's part of the Five Petals Collective, right?
Yeah, I think she founded the Five Petals Collective.
Yeah, she founded the Five Petals. Because there's all these issues with like dealing with their pharmacists and their doctors and their like official like healthcare capacity people. So they do a bunch of stuff for each other. Right.
Yeah.
So it's this like, so anyway, so it's very interesting that, yeah, she kind of created this because she was feeling frustrated in dealing with these imperious, self-involved, you know, healthcare assholes, basically. So,
and like she started this collective because they get welfare checks, but the welfare checks aren't enough to actually cover all of their needs.
Yeah.
So anything that they can't produce themselves, they buy with welfare. And then the rest of the time, the collective works to make sure that everyone else has what they need, right?
Yeah.
And enough food, enough clothes.
Yeah. So we have this sort of like, you have this endemic poverty. I mean, I assume elderly poverty. They seem to all be older. It's not clear.
She feels like the main character feels like she's older, but there's definitely young people that she's working with.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I think this is maybe kind of like one of those stories that actually like, never directly deals with it. Like, but I think like, in the periphery kind of deals with this issue. Like, yeah, like there's mass. This is a society where there's large swaths of the population who are extremely poor and there's very little social safety net for them. And so what they're doing is banding together and forming that social safety net for each other, which is super cool. Actually, I
really liked it. It was sort of like this neat story of resistance.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure. So at one point, a couple of cops show up and they're from the antitrust authority.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure exactly why the antitrust authority had come to harass these people.
Yeah. Well, something about like, yeah, like I think like they're like, they were suspecting they were abusing their social
their welfare
and healthcare. Yeah.
Like, so.
Which makes sense that, you know, kind of as the welfare and as the social assistance gets more and more meager, the enforcement of it gets increasingly strict and, you know, the bureaucracy of it grows to manage it better and to, you know, in welfare, you get this weird, like, sort of inquisitional effect.
Yes.
And I think it kind of goes back to, like, the Reagan era, you know, talking about, like, you know, Reagan's welfare queen from Chicago.
Yeah.
You know, in this notion. So you kind of get this inquisition, I think, and particularly as people on social assistance and people in the broader society just get more and more desperate. This notion of like someone on being on welfare who shouldn't be or someone taking advantage of welfare just gets people's blood boiling. Right. Having too much social assistance or violating social assistance rules or getting something when other people don't becomes a huge issue. And I think that then like the state and the social assistance edifice can kind of leverage that, right? And so like, then leverage that into more power for itself.
Yeah.
And then you kind of get this, yeah, again, like I think, yeah, like I did, like a welfare inquisition, like, should you be on welfare? How sick are you, huh? Huh?
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The deserving and the undeserving.
Yeah.
Well, you could get a job if you wanted, you just don't want to. So
yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, and presuming just a whole bunch of things. Yeah, and like here you have a bunch. Yeah, presuming a bunch of things about that person's like health and well-being, and then also again their social status and their their mental health and all these things. So yeah. So
and it's but it's also creates a huge administrative burden.
Oh, absolutely. These things are so costly, so much more costly than the waste that they.
Like, could you imagine actually having these two cops that go out and like personally find a person and issue violation tickets for monopolizing someone's social availability?
Yeah. You called your pharmacist too many times. Here's an $80 ticket. Yeah, that person's getting paid like $70,000 to $80,000 a year by our current like wage standards. So yeah.
Like you, and there's two of them. Yeah. So now all of a sudden you're like, okay, so I paid two people. The amount of time that I went out there with these two people would have been enough to provide what the person on the phone needed.
Yeah.
But instead, I'll send two people out to tell them why they can't have that thing.
Yeah. But again, it becomes this like whole issue about moral authority.
Exactly.
So this is where I think, and I'm always, I guess this story made me think like about like budgets as moral documents. right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, budgets and policy, these are all, and so there is, we in Canada and the United States have a very Protestant work ethic informed, you know, morality. And so we have this sort of notion of what people should do. But here we have in this, in the collective, you actually have people who have been barred from working by capital, essentially, are working for themselves in a collectivized nature, each according to their ability, each according to their need. And it's really beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. I really liked it.
Yeah. All right. Should we move on to the branch?
Yeah.
All right. So the branch is the worst of these. No, just kidding. By Eugene Lim. Am I saying that right?
I think so.
Yeah. Anyway, the branch is just about a guy who lives in like a super tech overloaded cyber. He's a cyborg. You know, everyone has, you know, think Altered Carbon. Think the pilot of Altered Carbon. Like, you're just like continuously bombarded. But he goes into a library, and like libraries are all like electromagnetically shielded. And you go in there and you can't use your implants. And you just like look at a book. But you don't like go in and like pick a book off the shelf. There's like a dapper, well-dressed bourgeois person who will like pick, like will like assess you and pick a book for you. Like a kind of like a sage providing a spiritual experience.
Yeah.
It's just so pretentious. It's just so like, exquisitely.
Okay. And you come in, you talk about problems. Like, it's like your librarian is your counselor.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, you just vent about what's bothering you. They ask you some questions. They help you through. And then they say, okay, let's go on a tour of the library. This and points out this book or that book. And maybe you'd like these. But remember, take time to browse. That's the important thing.
Yeah, it's just wild. Yeah, so like it's just, and again, nothing. This to me was the most like tangential and far away from the idea of work.
Yes,
it was actually this book belongs in the Wired eight stories about the future of leisure. Eugene, yeah, just that one kid in class who was like, oh, I'm gonna do this. You know, like just takes the
while work and leisure are intimately.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just like, oh, shut up.
Tangled.
Anyway. So, yeah, I hated it. And it's a notion that the most bourgeoisie interpretation of reading for leisure, was taken as like, yeah, this is what the library is. And I think, and also if you, have you looked at a library lately? They are the opposite. They're moving in the opposite direction of this. They're becoming major information commons for people who can't afford to own or rent their own information commons.
Yeah.
That's what they should be actually moving forward, not these like stick up their butt, like imperious, self-involved Luddite.
I think in some ways the one thing that maybe is kind of accurate is the librarian sort of acting as a counselor, because libraries do a lot of sort of social work now.
Yeah, increasingly so. Yeah,
people who have mental illness or facing abject poverty.
Well, yeah, people have addiction issues.
These sorts of things will often wind up in a library because it's like a public space that doesn't cost money to be at.
Yeah.
So they're able to just show up there. And then the librarian is sort of the person who's like, oh, okay, well, I have this person who doesn't have a home and it's cold outside and I can't, like,
we can't have them live inside the library. So we're going to find you a place.
They can't live here, but I also don't want to send them outside where the, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So
they do this sort of social work role, which, I mean, it was sort of similar, but I don't know. As a counselor, you're right. It did feel very bourgeois rather than sort of the proletariat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, have you even read Proust?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And
this person goes in because he got a weird call from his sister about a son having an eating disorder or something. You're like, oh, okay. Well, like, that's a legitimate problem, absolutely. But it's very different from going in and saying, like, I have nothing to eat.
Yeah. And then this notion that high literature, that, like, you know, that sophisticated literary discourse soothes the soul.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, oh, fuck off. You know, I can't believe it. Anyway, I really disliked the branch. I thought it was just, yeah, it missed the point in my mind. And is the most egregious example of what we're talking about in the discounting of productivity in work.
Yeah. Yeah. So the next story, Maximum Outflow by Adam Rogers. I really like the story. It's like futuristic janitors.
Yeah. Like our sewage, like maintenance workers. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I guess not janitor, maintenance worker is better because they're not just cleaning. They're doing all sorts of replacing filters and stuff that's beyond like has reached its end of lifespan sort of thing. Yeah. So
they're like future plumbers, but so much more with data.
Yeah. Like the story seemed to be set, in like a self-contained city.
Yeah. Yeah. They even say like living in the city is like living in a terrarium.
Yeah. Yeah. Like almost everything is recycled. The air is, you know, purified and put back in through and, you know, the particulate matter is taken out and whatever used for fertilizer or something. I don't know.
It's hyper efficient.
Very efficient. Yeah. And they say that there's something has gone wrong, that this maintenance worker finds, but it's not showing up on the systems. Like the computer doesn't notice it, but they're like, something is happening and we don't know exactly what. And they find out that it's related to the unrecoverable liquid waste, where it's like the small amount of stuff that can't be
recovered.
Yeah. And they said like for this entire city, it's microliters. So like we're looking at like a tiny, tiny amount of stuff.
Yeah.
And it just sort of is supposed to like flow out of the city and
yeah,
it's gone.
Yeah.
But there's a clog and it's because of, I really liked the reason for the clog.
Yeah. This was perfect.
But it was like cleaning wipes that couldn't be recycled.
Those baby wipes that you're not supposed to flush down the toilet, even though they say flushable on them because that's just marketing. Yeah.
Don't flush them.
Those things, don't flush them. You will destroy a very delicate eco. Yeah. Terrible. Yeah. They're terrible things. Necessary, but terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I really liked the story that it was like, it's one person who, you know, had on the job training,
yeah,
but knows the guts of this city inside and out.
Yeah.
Just goes and does the job and all of the like,
yeah. Yeah. Here you have a laborer. Here you have like, a skilled laborer, like a trained in his craft, and he just goes in and he solves a problem.
And it's a problem that other people didn't believe existed.
Yeah.
Because the computer didn't tell them that there was a problem. So how could there be?
Yeah.
So I kind of like that, where it's like, yeah, this person is just so intimately aware and involved that they know.
Yeah. So I think Maximum Outflow by Adam Rogers wins the most on topic award.
Yeah.
For this.
Yeah.
Congratulations. You managed to actually write a story about work.
On topic.
Yeah, it was on topic. No, and that's very impressive, given some of the digressions. No, and not to be again, you know, I think all of these stories are actually pretty well written. Credit.
Yeah. Right. No, I think I enjoyed.
I don't want to leave the impression that these are bad stories. I was glad to have read them, but I think just in terms of like, again, and what we're talking about, that analysis of like, if you're going to talk about it, this one actually talks about work and actually talks about work in a meaningful and complete way. In a way that almost none of the other stories do.
Yeah.
It was really impactful for me. And I think gives the best thing of like, what if there's going to be a future in work, the future in work is in people like, you know, yeah. You know, doing things and caring about them and being, you know, knowledgeable and skilled and using their human creativity, you know. And this is the thing, the automation isn't so bad if we automate things to release people out of like moving their arm up and down to like creating and thinking about things. But, you know, the issue is often we're automating things so people, instead of people like pulling a lever up and down, they're just being discharged into unemployment and poverty and hopelessness. But, you know, if we can be moving people into like doing, you know, analysis and creative thinking and, you know, and designing and those sorts of things, and we can, the automation, workforce automation can be a really good thing for us, but I'm skeptical about the ability for that to actually happen given the current means of production as they exist.
Yeah. When the goal of our system is for capitalists to squeeze every further dollar for themselves, they don't care about what happens to the workers. They just care if it's going to be more profitable in the very short term. So the last story then.
Compulsory by Martha Wells. I also really like this one. It's about, how would you describe this thing? It's wild. It's like a cyborg. It's a robot, but it also has like biological components, like kind of vat grown.
I don't know if they're vat grown. They might be, but it's a security unit.
Yeah, it's a security unit, and it's like a cyborg security robot.
This is Martha Wells. She's writing in her Murderbot universe.
Yeah.
So this is a very short story about Murderbot that happens prior to All Systems Red. For anybody who's read All Systems Red or the rest of those four novellas, which are, I think, well worth reading.
Yeah.
So check out Murderbot by Martha Wells. They're all great. So this is sort of, this gives you a taste of what Murderbot would be like.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's great. And so it's just about this like, yeah, security bot that is like loves watching TV basically because his job is so boring. But then something exciting happens and he leaps into action in a way he's not supposed to.
Well, and yeah, this is, yeah, exactly. Murderbot is famous for the facade of indifference to humans,
mm-hmm. but actually cares
and actually does a really good job. So there's like some humans, I guess they're doing mining probably.
Yeah. So again, we actually have again, productive work. So,
so there's a few people who are whatever, I guess they'd be like your driller right now, like in the oil field sort of thing. Like they're guiding the machines that do this drilling, but one of them falls off a platform and is near a fan and is going to die.
Yeah. And Murderbot is there to
something
prevent worker insurrection, like, and to like control the human workers inside the site.
Yeah. Or possibly protect them in case somebody else attacks them.
Right.
But yes, mostly to prevent workers rising up and seizing the means of production.
A job which he neglects to save this person.
Yeah. Yeah. So this person is like imminent death and the murder bot goes down and rescues them. Really not supposed to do that. And the system that, you know, is supposed to control murder bot's behavior keeps telling them not to do that. And in fact, attempts to kill murder bot to prevent them from doing the rescue. But murder bot obviously has hacked through that system and is safe, but
hooray. Yeah.
Woo.
So great story. Really great.
Yeah. Like it's a fun little Murderbot story. I was very curious though about, again, like I'm in all of Martha Wells' stories, I'm curious about these things. The future feels very unsafe.
Yeah.
in Martha Wells' worlds.
Well,
that like this person falls off a platform and almost dies through probably no fault of their own. Like it seemed like it was a legitimate accident, or perhaps one of their friends pushed them off.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Can put a rail on that. Mind Corp.
When that person fell and was about to be killed, they would have been fined by the company they work for what was it? They were going to be fined for almost clogging the collectors. So like they almost died and the company doesn't face repercussions, but the worker that almost died faces repercussions.
Yeah.
Because they almost caused a problem for the company. You're like, what kind of world do we live in at the future?
Well, I mean, this is, I think, a growing...
The company didn't actually experience any losses from this, but the potential for losses is enough to levy a fine against somebody.
Yeah. And this is what happens when companies set the policies.
Wow.
They set policies that are advantageous to the companies.
So then I'm wondering about, like, what union do they belong to? And how do they sort of, like...
Yeah.
What sort of tension is there between labor and capital that might mediate these sort of fines? Like, can you go back to someone and be like, I am not paying these fines. The company should have had a safety fence up, but they didn't.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. I think we're kind of getting into the macro of these stories and unions in the future of work. Unions are absent completely.
Yeah, there is no organized labor in the future of work.
There's a subliminal,
which was super disappointing. Yeah,
this subliminal presupposition that unions are archaic and have no place in the future of work, or that they've been involved in a struggle with capital and have lost, that they're defeated. And this is, again, like, when it's insidious, you know, it's just like this insidious sort of thing about like how we continuously, again, like a libertarian, like right wing agenda has just kind of been subliminally woven into things. So that's basically I'm all out of takes on this. How are you doing?
No, I think that's it for me. Okay. But let's just do like a quick rundown again of all of the jobs we found. So,
okay. Yeah.
In the future of work, we will have sex workers, internet sex workers, lawyers, internet lawyers. We'll have fake doctors.
Yeah.
We'll have journalists.
Yeah, I guess just psychologically unwell journalists. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll have social workers.
Yeah.
Paid or unpaid.
Collectivized social workers.
We'll have librarians?
I guess.
Sure. Was that the worker or I guess.
I don't know. Yes. I mean, that was a person who was presumably getting paid.
We'll have librarians / counselors.
Yeah.
We'll have maintenance workers.
Yeah.
And we'll have cyborgs.
Murder bots. Yeah.
We'll have murder bots.
All right. So that's...
And miners. And also miners.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So overall, just to kind of like as a recap, I think most of these stories felt like they were tangentially related to the future of work and were more interested in the future as a complete system.
Yeah.
Which is understandable. I get that. But it left me unsatisfied. I was really hoping to be able to have like a deeper look at how work might be.
Yeah.
Left me disappointed in how people view the future, and that, capital has won out and workers are just fodder.
Yeah. It's disappointing, discouraging that when people ask to imagine the future, they imagine a right wing capitalist future.
Yeah.
So,
and I think I personally reject that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's I think part of why this podcast got started, to get ahead of those narratives and to challenge the presumption that that's the way it's got to go.
And organized labor is as important today as it was 50, 100, 200 years ago. Yeah. We need more of it. We need more organized labor.
Yeah, absolutely. Should we plug the Hugo's blog post about unions?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. The Hugo Book Club.
Our good friends of the podcast. And you're a member of the Hugo Book Club, I believe.
I am a member of the Hugo Book Club.
Yeah.
The Hugo Book Club, and we'll post a link to this. Yeah. But the Hugo Book Club has a really great blog post from the 18th of December. And it's Imagine the Future of Organized Labor, where our author has done a really deep dive into sort of how people view organized labor in the future. And it's a great look at sort of the history of science fiction writing and how organized labor fit into the writing and representation of the future.
Yeah. Do you wanna do that for our next episode? We'll do like 8 examples of unions we'll get the author on and we'll talk about it.
Yeah, we could definitely try that, for sure.
Narrative, yeah. Okay, yeah. Well, we'll see. With that, shall we close?
Yeah.
All right.
That's it for me.
So just a reminder to everyone to please, if you like this episode, it's a little different. We're trying something new. We're trying to, be more literate and more conceptual. Please let us know if you like this, or if you're like, no, go back to just talking about movies. Just shoot us an email, shoot us a tweet. Additionally, we would really like it if you could do whatever you could to push us out to your friends and colleagues or people who kind of have similar interests to you. There is a lot of we acknowledge there's a lot of left podcasts, a lot of left media criticism, but I think we do something that's unique, and we would like to see its impact maximized. So if you share that value, please, post about us in your social medias and in your internet communities, as well as just, spreading the word IRL.
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter @ Econo Boyd. Or you can email me, Marshall, MARSHALL, @ androidsandassets.ca.
You can find me on Twitter @ Steve Droids. That's Steve Droids, plural, not Steve Droid. You leave. You don't talk to him or them. You don't talk to them. Okay. All right. And you can also tweet us at Androids and Assets or at Asset Droid. And my email is steve@androidsandassets.ca.